Well, hello, Slingers. Welcome back to another Word Slinger podcast. I got a good one for you today. I got my good friend J.D. Barker. I co-host with him on the Writers Inc. podcast. We're going to be talking murder, vampires, and more, so stick around.
It's the Word Slinger podcast, where story matters. Build your brand. Write your book. Redefine who you are. It's all about the story here. What's yours? Now, here's the guy who invented pants optional, Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger.
Word Slinger.
This segment of the Word Slinger podcast is being brought to you by me. Now, if you'd like to support me and my work, this podcast, whatever else I'm doing, you can do that best by going and buying one of my books or a whole bunch of my books. Go to kevintomlinson.com/books, where you'll find an entire library of things waiting for you to discover. Go find your next new favorite read, and you'll be helping me out, which means I can continue to help you out. Well, I am Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger. Thank you for tuning in to this week's Word Slinger podcast. Every week I sit down, there's a day I've dedicated to sitting down and recording this stuff and putting together this show. And it's not easy, I gotta tell you. There's a lot of work that goes into producing a podcast. I wish it were just as simple as sitting down and talking to the camera and talking to the microphone. And maybe one day it will be. When the show is sort of paying for itself and I can afford to hire somebody to do all the like editing and stuff for me, then we'll talk. But for now, it's all on me. And you know, it's funny because I did this interview with JD yesterday or a few days ago, my time, a couple of days ago, my time. And he actually asked at the end, like, why? It's a lot of work. Why do you do it? How do you have time to write? And that was a good question. That kind of question shakes me a little because, you know, I think about this. I'm like, well, why am I doing it? Like, what is the purpose? Like, what am I getting out of it? And yesterday, so I do this daily journaling thing, and I wrote down, like, I asked myself a question, and then I come up with three ideas. That's part of a whole process, this whole three things thing that I do. And I asked myself, you know, what are the benefits I get from the Wordslinger podcast? And, you know, I'm still kind of figuring out what the Wordslinger podcast is now. I think I like the direction it's going. I think I like, you know, how it's shaping up and who I'm serving with it. But the benefits I'm getting from it are things like, well, number one, I mean, I'm connecting with people. It's a great opportunity to connect and network with people that I admire. The people that, you know, there's people in my life that I'm talking to now that I'm bringing into the show that I want to introduce to the world. If you don't already know these people, I want you to get to know these people the way I know them. But then it gives me an opportunity. It's an excuse to reach out and talk to and learn from people that I see out there kind of accomplishing the sort of things that I dream of accomplishing. And I figure if I dream of accomplishing it, you probably do too, or someone among you, or you have a dream, and the hope that I have is that this will inspire you to go out, to go boldly in the direction of your dreams. I think that was Walt Whitman. So that's part of it. Another reason for getting up and doing this every week, even when it becomes work, even when sometimes it feels like work, is there is benefit to having a discipline and also to doing creative work of any kind. Like coming back to do this because I said I would, it does something, you know? And I think that if you're a writer or an entrepreneur or, you know, you do some creative work or you have a small business, whatever it is, what I think you could take from this as a kind of lesson is that just making the commitment to do it, not even knowing for sure how it's going to benefit you, like maybe it's never going to benefit you financially. Maybe this podcast will never bring me readers or dollars or any of the things that I'm trying to get out of it. Maybe that won't happen, but I committed to doing it. It's meaningful to me, and I'm seeing how it can help me grow as a person, as a writer, as a small business owner. I mean, it's helping me grow. So there's a second reason. And a third reason is it is a learning opportunity. Like everyone I talk to, there's something I can learn and incorporate into my life and career. And so it helps me grow as a writer, as a person. And through that, I hope the goal here is that it's also helping you grow in those ways. So, three reasons. There you go. And we'll loop back around on that later. So anyway, I don't want to delay this. Please stick around after the interview because I do have an Ask Kevin Anything this week. So stick around for that. And I hope you enjoy this chat with J.D. Barker. Well, this is a special treat, and I've been looking forward to this, actually, J.D. But J.D. Barker, New York Times number one bestseller, international bestseller. Sorry, man, I cut you right off. Go ahead.
It's hard to keep me from talking.
Same here, man. That is my that's I don't know if it's a curse or a blessing, but as a podcaster, I guess that comes in kind of handy.
I'm envious because I've been listening to your podcast since you came back on. And you know, like you carry the whole show all by yourself, and like
sometimes.
I've been amazed, you know, at people that can do that. You know, like I used to listen to Howard Stern all the time, and like the idea of 4 hours, 5 hours on the air, just nonstop, all him. I could never figure out how somebody did that, but you seem to pull it off on here when you're not interviewing somebody. So
yeah, and I like interviewing people. I mean, I do like that. That's part of my show, and I'm definitely going to continue that. And I think people get a lot out of that. But I actually had people reach out to tell me like they like the solo episodes. So I want to make sure I do some of those too. So
yeah, anyway. Man, it's kind of laid back. I enjoyed it. Because I take the lazy easy way out. Like we've got what, four other people on Writers Inc. You know, so right. I just have to chime in at the beginning, chime in at the end, and. In and out, and I'm done, and it's an afterthought. But
let's talk a little bit about Writers Inc. By the way, let's do that. So that's part of your sphere. Like, what? So you were kind of the like start of that, right? Like that was always your show, and then you brought others in, or did you join?
It was Jay that started it, Jay Thorne. Okay. So he came up to me at the Horror Writers Convention, and I forget what year this was, probably 4 or 5 years ago at this point. And I had no idea who he was. We had never met before. But he had just thrown the idea out there, like, hey, would you want to do a podcast just about the writing industry or about books or something? He just kind of threw a floater out there. And I honestly had been trying to find something that I could do because I'm autistic, which we talked about on the air and off the air. I was diagnosed when I was 22 with something called Asperger's. Now you're not allowed to say that anymore. You have to say you're on the spectrum. Like, it's, you know, the language is always changing. But either way, I've got issues. And one of them is public speaking or talking in social situations. I mean, even right now on video, like it's difficult for me to make eye contact with you because for me to follow a conversation, I have to look off to the side. If I look at somebody's eyes, even on video, like in the back of my head, I have to tell myself, maintain eye contact.
You don't have to.
So like, I do, like, it's literally, I hear my own voice saying that, and it keeps me from being able to follow the conversations. So I figured doing a podcast would be a great way for me to get out there, you know, just build the public speaking. So Jay and I just kind of touched base. We figured, yeah, let's do it. We weren't quite sure what the show would be about. But I've been in this industry for a very long time, so I know a lot of people. And I reached out to a couple of other authors that I know and said, hey, would you be interested in coming on this show that we're putting together? And I got a surprising amount of yeses. So we just kind of hit the ground running with some fairly big names and just kept going and going.
Yeah, you guys have had, before I came along and since I've come along, I mean, you guys had a ton of the big hitters, you know.
Like, yeah, I think the only one that actually intimidated Jay, because Jay is fearless, and he's been doing the, you know, he's got what, 200-300 podcasts, I think, at this point. He's all over the place. But the only one that ever intimidated him was Matthew McConaughey.
Really?
And that That one sort of fell into our laps. You know, I happened to know a publicist who was working his new book, and Green Lights is fantastic if you get a chance to read it, because it's basically him just telling his stories. And you know, he reads the audiobooks. Like, I did the audiobook because it's basically him telling you the story. But yeah, so we got him on the show, and Jay called me ahead of time, and he called me after, and like, he was nervous before, he was nervous after. But you don't really catch it in the interview. And that was one of the earlier ones that we did. And then after that, I teed up, you know, a number of big names, like James Patterson's been on a couple of times, Dean Koontz, you know, Lisa Gardner, Meg Gardner, pretty much anybody in the thriller world. We've had him once, twice, some of them three or four times. So I guess he got a little used to it. Then we brought Zach in at one point, you know, cause he had been working with Jay on, another podcast, and they always had really good chemistry. And that was one of the few places where I actually did hear Jay, because it was one of the shows that I listened to. I always loved the banter that the two of them had. So I figured, well, if we bring in somebody who's funny to play off of Jay, I'll have, you know, be able to do less work. So yeah, I was all for that. And then we kind of did our own thing for a while. And then, you know, Jay eventually just got burnt out on it, you know, because it's a ton of work. You know, you've got to read the book. You've got to come up with the questions. You've got to talk to these people. You know, and just, he got tired of it. So we started bringing in other people, kind of created a revolving door sort of cast. And, you know, now we've got four other people on the show besides me. And, you know, I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's been interesting, man. I've enjoyed it quite a bit, and I've had a lot of people reach out, and like, this show was on an inadvertent 3 or 4 year hiatus. And so I had people actually reaching out to me, just grateful that they were hearing me on Writers Inc. So it's done well. It's doing well. I want to loop around to your writing career, man. And more than that, actually, because you've got this, every time we talk, you reveal some like secret from your past that that just blows my mind. Like, you solved a murder once. Now I'm running on memory here. I didn't go and research this before we chat, but I know some of your story. Like, you had a friend who was murdered, and you actually contributed to the investigation and solved that crime, right?
Yeah. So I went to my 20-year high school reunion. So this was back in 2009, back down in Florida. I graduated in the west coast of Florida. And when I walked in the door, you know, it was at a Holiday Inn, you know, like right out in the lobby, there's this big poster, and it said, "In loving memory of Tracy McClelland," which was this girl that I knew in high school. We worked together at Kentucky Fried Chicken. Like, who hasn't worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken? But, you know, she was really, you know, somebody I was really close to, because, you know, somebody who's autistic, it was very difficult for me to speak to anybody, let alone pretty girls. And Tracy was gorgeous, and she took the time to speak to me and kind of brought me out of my shell. So she's always had this special place in my heart. You know, it makes me wonder, you know, if I would have dated some of the people that I did moving forward, you know, like, had the courage to talk to even, you know, my wife, you know, at this point, if she hadn't had sparked that in me. So she's always been a very special person to me. But I walked into the reunion, and that poster was there, and I had no idea that anything had happened to her. We had kind of lost touch at that point. You know, it'd been a long time. So I talked to a couple of people at the reunion. Very few of my classmates actually knew what happened. So when I got back home, I called her and spoke to her sister, and her sister told me that Tracy had fallen on hard times. She had gotten pregnant with her, I think it was her third child. And she was a small girl. But she got big when she was pregnant, and she developed back problems. So after the baby was born, she was on pain meds for her back, and, you know, her doctor prescribed those. But then after a while, it got to the point where, you know, if you've known anybody on pain meds, you know, you build up a tolerance pretty quick. So it got to the point where her doctor wouldn't prescribe them anymore. He sent her off to a pain management clinic. So she started getting pain meds from there. Then, you know, those weren't enough. So then she went to the street and started buying them on the street. And over a couple year time frame, you know, that kind of became her life. And, you know, then she needed money to pay for those medications, because insurance wasn't picking up, you know, drugs that you're buying on the street. So she became a prostitute. She would sell herself to cover those medications. And at one point, you know, she went out, she disappeared for 3 weeks. Her family looked everywhere. Nobody had any clue where, you know, what happened to her, where she was. And then her body turned up. It was, somebody had stabbed her multiple times and they buried her in the back of a parking lot at a sweeping company. You know, one of those companies that just cleans the streets.
Yeah.
She was decomposed to the point where they couldn't ID her. Like normally they had to ID her from the serial numbers on her breast implants. But you know, they knew who it was. And you know, that was kind of it. There were very few clues. Nobody had any leads. The police investigated, but you know, an investigation like that, I mean, they saw her as a prostitute. They didn't put a whole lot of time into it. They kind of wrote it off. So me being the weird person that I am, I kind of took it upon myself to try and solve this thing. So I came up with this crazy plan. I created a website, and I embedded code in this website, and anybody who actually looked at this site, I could tell where you physically were in the world. It grabbed your IP address, your latitude and longitude. So you didn't have to input anything. You didn't have to click on anything. You just had to load up the site. And I named it whokilledme.tv. I basically created a fictitious television show, very similar to America's Most Wanted. That was kind of the vibe that I used with the initial website. And my thinking was, I'm going to start posting clues about this case on the website. You know, a normal person might look at it once or twice, you know, just to satisfy their curiosity. But anybody actually involved in the crime, they're going to keep coming back over and over again because they're going to see it as a way to get inside that investigation. Right. Figure out what the police know without having to put their face out there. So I created the website, put the code on there. And then I was like, well, how do I get people to actually go to this thing? You know, and I talked to my girlfriend from college, the one I mentioned who got me on and you know, all those TVs and movies and things, and told her what I was up to. And she said, well, why don't we really film this as a TV show or fake it? I can send you some cameras. We can, you know, some microphones, we can make this look real. So I took her up on that. I called a bunch of the local television channels in Tampa. That's where this her murder had taken place, and told them this TV show was going to be in their area filming an episode about my friend Tracy. If you'd like to come out and check out what we're up to, you're more than welcome to do that. All the networks up there started hyping it up. And the day that I showed up with my fake camera crew, we had about 300 volunteers that all came out to hang up posters and basically canvass the neighborhood. Now, the neighborhood where she died was a pretty sketchy place. So the police weren't comfortable with me going out there with, you know, basically my friends trying to solve a murder. But they were kind of all in with doing this because the case was dead and they were willing to try and revive it. So my camera crew and my sound people were all undercover cops. They were basically pretending to be, you know, so like the footage is horrible. You know, it's like cameras all over the place. The audio was bad. They didn't know what they were doing, but they looked like they knew what they were doing. So we spent the whole day just flowering the neighborhood with flyers, you know, talking to people, following up on the clues that, you know, they had before, posting anything new to the website, exactly like what we expected. And somebody back at police headquarters was watching the hits on that website. That night we got a phone call from a reporter at one of the networks. She said, hey, somebody just called me and said that he bought a house and the house that he bought is the place where your friend died. And he wants to talk to you. So I called him up on a recorded line, you know, told him it was recorded. And he basically laid out what happened. He said that he bought this house from a girl that he had known for a long time. And one night she had gotten drunk and she confessed to him that Tracy had been killed in the house. And he knew every aspect of the particular crime. He knew, you know, why she died. He knew where she died. He knew who killed her, everything. So I relayed all this information back to the police detective. And at that point, I thought, you know, I basically got this thing solved. Police detective went into this house and he went in with CSI and he investigated the wrong room. Like we knew where she was initially stabbed. We knew she bled out in a back bedroom. He investigated the wrong back bedroom, even though the owner of the house was standing there telling him, no, it's that room. It's that room. It's that room. That seemed really hokey to me. And I wasn't sure, you know, at first I thought the guy was just kind of sloppy. But these sort of things kept happening. Like when we got a clue about the case, I would give it to him and he would investigate it, but in kind of a half-assed way. And it got to the point where it just didn't seem like it could, you know, be an accident anymore. Like I found the car that they used to transport her body and he went out to check it out himself rather than sending a CSI team. His report says that he found nothing abnormal. The next day the car was stolen and just vanished. You know, these things kept happening over and over again. I couldn't figure out why, but at this point we knew exactly who killed my friend. We knew why, we knew how, we knew where, we had all the details. But this detective kept flubbing the case and he wouldn't make an arrest. Then I kind of stumbled into something totally off the wall that I didn't expect. So in Tampa, Florida, if you die of natural causes back when this happened, like at a hospital or something, that hospital would have to file the paperwork to basically code you as deceased, and like the IRS mainframe and, you know, DMV credit cards, all those types of things that are all kind of fed off the same databases. If you die through as a homicide, it's up to the lead detective to file the paperwork in order to make that happen. So what we ended up learning is this lead detective, rather than file that paperwork, he put it in a drawer and he kept his homicide victims alive for the 20 some years that he was on the force. And he filed tax returns in their name. So every year he would file tax returns for all these people that he had supposedly investigated, bringing in, I think the final tally that I saw was $400,000 a year. Wow. That he was bringing in fraudulent tax returns. Now, his wife worked for the prison system in Tampa, so she would take that money when it hit the bank accounts. She would convert it into these debit cards that they used in prison, and then they would sell those debit cards on the street at 50 cents on the dollar. So that was basically how they laundered it. So I uncovered this giant scheme involving the lead detective, and he ended up losing his job. He was indicted. A federal indictment came down. I thought I was going to go into witness protection because, you know, like people were coming at me and telling me like, you know, we just didn't know who was involved at this point. Yeah. It was a big thing. So I solved the murder. The problem is like they still haven't made any arrests because Tampa PD is afraid to unravel this guy's case. You know, if they reopen her investigation and realize that he made mistakes there, defense attorneys are going to jump all over every single person that he ever convicted, you know, that's in prison right now, and try to overturn those cases. And from a financial standpoint, Tampa PD doesn't want to do that. They don't want to get involved. The FBI isn't allowed to step in unless they're invited. You know, that's only something that happens on TV. I've had that conversation. And I've been through three different mayors in Tampa, you know, trying to get the mayor to do something, and the mayor won't do anything either. So at this point, I've got a book that I wrote about it, mainly just to get all the facts down. Like when it took place, I wanted to get it all down on paper when it was fresh. But I've got a book that's done. I've got a TV show that's in the works, a documentary. So we'll see. My general thinking is I'm going to get this stuff out there. We're going to create enough noise where they're going to be forced to reopen the investigation, and then we'll see where the chips fall.
Man. I was going to ask you where the book was and the Netflix series and everything else that should be created around this idea. It's too bad do you still have all that footage and everything? The bad footage.
We do. Yeah. We've got all the bad footage. And the audio isn't that bad. I mean, you know, the funny thing is like back when we did this was 2009 to 2012 or so when we filmed all of this. Back then, video quality had to be perfect, you know, because you were filming for broadcast TV, you know, HD was brand new.
Yeah.
But you know, like a shaky cam, like they wouldn't, there was no way they would use that. But like in today's world, like that's the norm.
Yeah.
You know, like cell phone videos, you know, like they'll work with anything. So yeah, we've got, you know, I think it's something like 800 hours of audio and video related to all this. And some of the people that are involved are dead. You know, like I said, it was a sketchy part of town, a lot of drug dealers, things like that. So, you know, we're the only people that actually have, you know, that footage. So we'll see where it goes.
That's mind blowing, man. All right. I'm going to want to see all that at some point. But let's fast forward a little, because there's things not related to any of that, but in some ways, I'm sure. But, you know, you've got a pretty successful writing career at this point. You've done stuff with James Patterson. You did stuff with the Bram Stoker estate. Man, you're out there. You're all over the place. Where'd that start?
You know, it's funny because when I lecture, I tell people that I've captured lightning in a bottle so many times. Like if I'm outside, you don't want to stand next to me because sooner or later, you know, karma is going to try to even this out a little bit. I don't want to say things fell into my lap because that's, you know, I've hustled. I mean, don't get me wrong. But with the Bram Stoker thing, Forsaken, my very first novel, it was up for the Bram Stoker Award for Best Debut Horror Novel. And Bram Stoker's family read it and they liked my particular writing style. So they started to research me, and I've got a, you know, pretty lengthy history as a book doctor and a ghostwriter, basically working with other people, to fine tune a story. And that's a, you know, it's a, kind of a unique thing in this industry because most writers are very introverted. They don't work well with others. You know, being autistic and being a writer, I should definitely fall into that camp, but I've always been you know, I've never had an issue doing that. You know, I tend to sit down with whoever my co-author is going to be. We figure out who, you know, where our strengths are, where our weaknesses are, it kind of divide and conquer. So I had these conversations with the Stoker family, and they said, well, you know, we've been trying to find somebody to write a prequel to Dracula for a very long time. Is it something you'd be interested in? And originally I was going to turn it down. But then they sprang two things on me, which I didn't know. The first one was Bram Stoker originally wrote Dracula as a true story. And his publisher forced him to change it. And the second one was that Bram actually believed in vampires from the time he was a child till the time he died, to the extent that he had himself cremated after he died at a time in, you know, history, you know, where they didn't do that very often. It wasn't, right. wasn't the norm. And then they, you know, we talked, but like after I heard that, like I was in, cause like there was a story there. Yeah. The original 120 pages of the first 120 pages of Dracula were actually stripped out of the book. And that was basically what we decided we were going to focus on. It was very autobiographical. It was basically about Bram as a child, Bram growing up, but the reason he felt that vampires were real, and he sold it. The publisher didn't want to include all that because at the time Jack the Ripper was running around in London, yeah. You know, people believed that sort of thing. The occult was, you know, real, that it wasn't, you know, something you did to entertain yourself. You know, so like they stripped all of this stuff out. One of the things that we learned while we were working on this book is Bram kind of left breadcrumbs that we started to follow. So in today's world, if I write a book, I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit. I send my copy off to my editor in the US and they, you know, help clean up the text and they basically finalize that one copy. And then that final copy goes out to all the foreign publishers and it gets translated into all these different languages. But everybody's basically working off that same text. Back in Bram's day, it didn't work that way. So if Bram got, you know, a publisher that wanted to put out the book in a different language, let's say Germany contacted him, he would have to mail a copy himself off to that publisher in Germany. So what we learned is Bram stripped out all this stuff in the English and the UK versions, but he left it all in with the foreign publishers. And this went undiscovered for a very long time, mainly because Dracula is so popular. It's the second most popular book in the world from a sales standpoint next to the Bible. Yeah. But all these publishers, you know, if you buy a copy of Dracula right now, they're all working off the same text. They're working off, you know, basically the free version that's out there in public domain. So they're not going back and translating an original version of Dracula if they want to, you know, put it out in some new language. They're translating that public domain version. So the Stoker family started buying up first editions of Dracula and translating them back into English. And they started finding this totally different story. Dracula was married. There were other people in the castle. There were flying monkeys. I had no idea where Bram came up with that one. Lots of crazy stuff. But we incorporated whatever we could into the book that we eventually came up with called Dracul, and put it out there. And when we finished that first draft, we had to verify a lot of the data. We wanted to be careful with this because, you know, it's a very historical thing. People get doctorates in Dracula. So like you can't just throw out a fiction book out there like this, you know, without checking your facts. So yeah. I started researching this and it turns out there's only one copy of the original manuscript in the world that's known at this point. And it was found in a barn in Pennsylvania. Nobody really knows how it got there. Dacre Stoker speculated that it was traded at one point for a Walt Whitman text, but nobody really knows. A family inherited this farm from their grandparents. They found it in a trunk in the barn. It ended up going to auction. And Paul Allen bought it, the co-founder of Microsoft. So I reached out to Paul Allen's people, asked if there was any way Dacre Stoker and I could see this manuscript before we put out our book, just to see if we could confirm some of the stuff that we have in ours, hoping that those first 120 pages would be in there. Yeah. He agreed. So we flew out to Seattle. They locked us in a conference room, took away our cell phones, made us wear gloves. A couple guys kind of stood over us as we flipped through this thing. And it starts at page 123, I think was the first page. And it's actually crossed off and it says number one. You know, so like he doesn't have those first couple of pages either. So we weren't able to verify it that way. But as we started flipping through the book, we realized that we might be able to do something with the deleted scenes, because in today's world, you know, you delete a scene from your book, you know, you're basically just backspacing over it and it's gone forever. Mm-hmm. But when you're working on a, you know, a printed text, like Bram drew a line through the scenes that he didn't want to keep. So we started focusing on those deleted scenes, and we found many of them referenced the first 120 pages. So we were able to backtrack and kind of fill it all in and make sure that our story was consistent. And then we got it out there. But it's a crazy tale. Again, Bram thought that Dracula was real, thought vampires were real. The author's note at the end, to me, is my favorite part, because we lay out exactly, you know, what we had. And everything that you thought was basically fake and fiction in the book turns out is the most real stuff in the entire story.
It's your whole thing about lightning in a bottle, man. It blows my mind. I think I always think that I have like an eclectic collection of like personal stories, but then I spend 20 minutes chatting with you and I can't compete with any of that. Let's move forward a little. You got a new book coming out as of the time of this recording, it's in like about a month that this book comes out. Behind a Closed Door. I actually have a personal connection to this book because I was one of the people you allowed to read an early version of it, offer some edits. I don't know if any of my edits were worthwhile, but I at least got to read the book before anybody else did. Tell me a little bit about that. What's the premise of Behind a Closed Door?
So this was a fun one to write. So it's an erotic thriller, which is something I've never done before, at least not under my own name. I've done a lot of the ghostwriting stuff and book doctor stuff in that world. But my general thinking, you know, I've got a bunch of films and TV shows in various stages of Hollywood hell. So I get the chance to talk to a lot of producers and writers and directors. And in Hollywood, there seems to have been a trend in like when it comes to sex in cinema, almost like a pendulum, like it swung just a little too far to one side, where they're basically completely skirting away from any type of sex in a movie right now. They're scared. But the people in Hollywood believe that pendulum is going to swing back a little bit. So they've been looking for something that they could use as a catalyst to do that. Basically something they're looking for, something similar to like Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction. Like they kind of see that as being a resurgence. Like that could be something that's going to come back around. So I wrote this book with that specifically in mind. And the book itself is about a husband and wife. They're having marital problems. The husband had a little bit of an infidelity. I won't go into the details, but you start off and they're in therapy. And at that initial therapy session, their therapist suggests that they try an app called Sugar and Spice, which is very similar to Truth or Dare for adults. Mm-hmm. They shy away from it at the beginning, but then they eventually load it up on their phone. It's a little clunky at first. It starts throwing out some truths and dares, but it spices things up for them. So they start going down this little bit of a rabbit hole because it's rekindling this relationship that they thought they had lost. But the dares that it puts out there tend to escalate. And at one point, the wife gets one that says, "Would you kill a total stranger to save someone you love?" And when she clicks yes, a map pops up on her phone with a little pin, basically mm-hmm. a destination, and then hijinks ensue. So it's a fun story. So it basically starts off very similar to like 50 Shades of Grey meets David Fincher's The Game, and then gets into a very high end, high octane roller coaster ride.
Yeah, yeah. I felt at times I was too young to be reading the book, honestly. It's not in my purview of books that I normally.
Well, let me ask you a question. Have you ever written a sex scene in one of your books?
I'm very tame, man. Yeah, I have, but I mean, nothing so explicit that you might not even call it a sex scene. It's a love scene. Yeah.
But it's a tricky thing because, when you go into a book like that, you basically have to decide whether or not you want to show that or you want it to take place. Literally the term is behind a closed door.
Yeah.
So your characters kind of switch off the lights and, you let your imagination run. I kind of went all in because I felt like I needed to show the problems that this couple, what they were experiencing. And, part of it was related to sex, so like you can't just dance around that. I figured it would be better for the reader to see it.
I agree. I don't think you did anything wrong with the book. I'm just, I have my own. Well, maybe I'm more of a prude than I realized, but I didn't dislike the book or anything. I just, at times, I'm like, I checked to make sure my wife wasn't watching me read it or something.
The truth of it is, your wife is probably reading it too, and she's not.
She's
telling
gonna read. She's gonna love it. But let's now. What we're gonna dive into next is a little rough, but we're gonna talk it through because it's important. And I think it's important for you know, my listeners to hear how things went down here. I got to see all this happen from the inside. So unlike everyone else that I saw commenting and saying and doing things online, I actually knew the actual truth of what was happening. So it was a little hard to watch, but there was some controversy surrounding this book and the way the book was promoted. Let's talk a bit about the email.
Do we have to? I guess we should, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you have the book itself, yeah, the publishing path was very odd on this one. So my agent sent it off to all the different publishing companies. We started getting offers in. While that was playing out, the scouts picked up on the book. And scouts are basically people that work for the publishers that report back to people in Hollywood. You know, like, this is a book that might be film worthy. You need to check it out. Like, those kind of conversations. So while we were talking to the publishers, we started getting phone calls from Sony, from Netflix, from HBO, from all these production companies that were interested in the book. And we ended up selling the film rights before we sold the publication rights. On the publishing side, I started getting weird phone calls. I got a phone call from a friend of mine who worked for Penguin Random House, and she told me, listen, they're about to offer on your book. You need to say no. And her answer, her response, and I asked her why, and her response was, well, they're about to lay off a lot of people, including the editor that is interested in your title. I got a similar call from somebody who worked over at HarperCollins. So I started these back channel conversations with different publishers, and I ended up striking a deal with Simon & Schuster, where they basically took on my imprint, Hampton Creek Press, as a print and distribution partner. So basically I'm my own publisher through Simon & Schuster, and they're handling my print and distribution. So I was able to circumvent that. So that was all playing out while this email was in the works. And the email itself, you know, like, this actually started back in September of last year. So now we're in April. Yeah. The controversy itself happened in January. But the email itself was crafted back in September. So when the film rights sold, you know, I brought in a ton of PR people to basically start pushing this book. You know, I wanted to do whatever we could, but I wanted to do something different. I learned a long time ago to basically look at what everybody else is doing to promote a title and then try to come up with something that nobody is doing and then use that to promote mine. And that tends to work very well. So I had a lot of conversations with PR and marketing people. They would read the book, you know, it's an erotic thriller. So like they would go there. And a lot of those conversations turned edgy, you know, the things that they wanted to do. You know, one PR company was creating a deck of playing cards, very similar to the Sugar and Spice game that, you know, is in the app.
Yeah.
Another one was talking, you know, commercial ideas. I quickly learned that the route that was pushed on me the heaviest was to reach out to influencers to basically try to light up Book Talk, or in this case, Spicy Book Talk, which is another whole world. And I got a crash course in how the whole influencer system works. And, you know, pretty much everything that we see, you know, where somebody's pushing a product is a paid sponsorship, whether they disclose it or not. You know, they're getting either a free book, or they're getting paid, or they're getting this, or they're getting that. And you know, honestly, like, these things play out on the Tonight Show. You can watch the Tonight Show. If an actor is on there and they're wearing a particular suit, you know, like, that suit was given to them so that they could be in front of a camera with it. Like, these things are all over the place. So we started researching influencers, and there's a number of companies. If you go on Google and just say, how do I work with, you know, social media influencers, these companies will come up. But they basically take a product, and they'll take your product and put it in front of the right people, and those people can market it. And in order to do that, you have to, you know, create basically a sell sheet. So you basically describe what your product is, and it could be anything. It could be clothing. It could be a car. You know, in this case, it's a book, but you describe what it is. Then you create your pay scale. You create some sample ideas for, you know, videos, for social media posts, for images, whatever it might be. In our case, we worked with other influencers that had had created viral campaigns in the past, and created a couple of different things. But we basically took all this information, we plugged it into an email, and then we used a company called Insight IQ to basically create a marketing list of influencers that have pushed spicy content before on social media. So they've done everything from books and movies to cologne. The latest one is Cupid cologne. So if you go on TikTok, you're liable to see ads for Cupid cologne, like, they're behind that. So we created this mailing list, roughly about 500 or so people, created the email that was meant to go out to this list to solicit them to create the, you know, the videos for this particular campaign. All this took place back in September, and we kind of finalized it and you know, closed it. We use a program called MailChimp, which I think, you know, if you've got authors listening, I think every author out there is familiar with MailChimp. Whenever we create a new email in my account, we use a template. So I've got one email that's got my name up at the top, and there's a trademark version of my name. So it's like a certain color, a certain font. It's got that in there. You know, the format for the email is all in there. And we basically use that template to make sure that any messaging coming out from my camp is always consistent. So when we create an email, we copy that template, then we just change everything. So when my assistant went in there, he went in and he copied that template. He updated it with all this information for this email campaign that was supposed to go out to the, you know, these influencers, and he hit save and scheduled it to go out in January. But he left out a very important step at the bottom of that email. It always defaults to whoever you sent that that mailing to last. In my case, it was a group of book reviewers. He never changed that to the list of influencers that create spicy content. And nobody caught it, you know, so it was basically saved that way back in September and then, you know, just sat there. Then in January, the email went out, and I, you know, at first there, you know, I didn't hear anything. Like, it went out. I didn't even know it went out because we had scheduled it so long ago. And there was, you know, a dozen other email campaigns that went out, you know, between then and now. Couple days go by, and then I got a call from my PR firm, or one of them, and they said, hey, there's some stuff popping up on TikTok. You need to take a look at this. And then I saw a couple of these videos, and it was, you know, people, influencers that had gotten the message, and they were just completely tearing it apart and going off on it. And I couldn't figure out why, you know, because, you know, the people that were supposed to receive it were obviously accustomed to receiving this type of message. But it kept blowing up. So I put out an apology really quick, because that's what I was told to do, which was stupid because I didn't have any facts yet. I just threw something out there to try and you know, throw some water on the fire. Then right after I sent that message, I, you know, my assistant called me up. He's like, I know what happened. This, you know, I forgot to change this. So we realized that this message that was supposed to go out to group A ended up going out to group B. And there was no way to walk it back at that point. You can't, you know, unsend something that you sent through MailChimp. So we just can't have to kind of ride it out. But it escalated, you know, like one video turned into three, turned into 10, turned into 20. You know, by 1 o'clock that afternoon, I was getting phone calls from, you know, NBC and the Today Show, like all these, you know, large traditional press models that all wanted to talk to me about it. I called and spoke to a crisis management company really quick through a friend of mine. And, you know, I put out a statement, you know, which again was a mistake, because I didn't have all the facts. It was a knee jerk reaction. And, you know, in the end, they took, you know, whatever sentences they wanted to out of that particular statement and just kind of ran with it. And I learned very quickly, like the people that were actually talking about this, you know, and in many cases, I don't know that they even cared about the underlying issue. I think a lot of it was just about, you know, what can I do to draw likes and clicks and follows to my particular channel, which I can't blame them for, you know, that's their job. But I realized no matter what I said, it was going to be used against me. So I shut down. I just went quiet.
There's not a lot to do. I mean, speaking as a PR guy, you know, PR and marketing has been kind of my thing for several years now. And I would have advised you to do pretty much the same thing. Just keep going, do whatever you're doing, and don't make a comment for a while. People don't like that, but that's, you know, you can't deal with these crowds, man. You never apologize to the mob. That's rule number one. So there's a lot to learn from this, by the way. And I think you know, you have definitely learned something, but I think there's a lot that people watching this can learn, because I've done something similar in the past with the emails where I sent something, went to the wrong list, or something I didn't intend to go out right away went out right away. You know, it happens. So there's that lesson, which is sort of triple check everything. Make sure you're sending to who you think you're sending to. Make sure you know what you're sending. and then, you know, how to deal with the fallout of when things go wrong, man. What would your first and best piece of advice be to anyone who might have a similar, most of the people I know are not going to have this kind of problem. They're not dealing at things on the level and scale that you are, but what would you recommend? that they do.
Well, you know, honestly, I do think that this could happen to any author.
Yeah.
Mainly because, you know, like my goal in life is to sit down and write. You know, like mm-hmm. I don't want to spend time marketing. I don't want to spend time coming up with campaigns or generating emails or responding to this or doing social media. So in my world, when I could afford to, I hired people to do those things for me, you know, which is a blessing and also a curse because, you know, you get dependent on them to do it. So, you know, like I put trust in a lot of people to handle these kind of things for me. And what happened was, you know, a complete honest mistake. Like the guy who did it is still working for me. You know, it sucks, but you know, it happened, but I could see it happening to me. I could see it happen to anybody because, you know, I've sent texts to the wrong people. I actually texted my ex-wife once instead of my current wife, you know, like, and we've all done something like that, you know? Yeah. So like, I get it. And like at one point he's like, you know, when this was all breaking out, he was like, I'm going to put a video up on YouTube and explain exactly what I did. And I was like, no, you're not going to do that. Like I'm the public face of this. They're already beating up on me, you know? And this is a 19-year-old kid who's got, you know, everything ahead of him. Like, what is the point, you know, getting his name and face? Like it would just be silly. It would just add to the fire and they would just pounce on them. So I didn't let them do it. You know, so yeah, so now I'm dealing with the fallout of it. But you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you either have to micromanage absolutely everything and then hope that you're perfect, which none of us are, or you've got to delegate, but you know, things are going to happen. They're going to go wrong. I mean, unfortunately I'm a bit of a public you know, I've got a profile out there. People know who I am. And like, you know, that makes it just that much more salacious.
Yeah.
The thing that honestly got me though, is when my publicist reached out to the various, you know, entities that wrote about this, you know, the bigger, you know, Publishers Weekly, NBC, you know, some of these bigger names, and told them what actually happened. None of them had an interest in amending their story or talking to me about it or getting the actual facts out there. It was all about, you know, let's create the clickiest, you know, headline that we can and go with it. You know, so I just really lost a lot of faith in humanity through the whole thing.
Keep the faith in humanity, lose the faith in mass media. That's where the
but I mean, at the same time, like, you know, a lot of my friends came out, offered their support. You know, a lot of people, this kind of thing has happened to in the past. Yeah. You know, anybody who's been in this kind of industry in the public eye, you know, for any length of time, something is bound to blow up at one point or another. You know, I would have rather whatever my incident was waited another 10 years, but you know, it happens. So you got to deal with it and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. So rumors that you did this on purpose, untrue.
Completely untrue. Honestly, like the only part of the whole thing that I would have actually considered doing is I do believe that influencers should get paid for the content they create.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I was fully on board with creating a campaign similar for book reviewers to pay them for reviewing my book. Because I honestly feel bad when I send an ARC copy to somebody, that's like a $10 spend to me, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm sending somebody a book. I'm asking them to take hours and hours of their time to read that book. Then I'm asking that same person to create a video or create a blog post or whatever it might be. But they're putting in a ridiculous amount of time for literally no real payoff. And like, I don't think that that's right. So I'm on board, you know, I don't know what the end game is to something like this, but I am totally fine with creating a model where influencers do get paid for reviewing books.
Is that your way of saying you're going to pay me for this interview now?
I have already mailed you a check. it might be an unpopular opinion among other authors because, you know, a lot of authors do depend on that free press in order to get the buzz out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've had conversations with people that have told me, you know, I can't send somebody a book. That's expensive. You know, it's like, you got to flip that on its head. You're spending, that's a $10 spend in versus everything they're going to do for you. And like, I, in today's world, the influencers, they have a lot of power.
Right.
You know, like we've talked about this on the air and off the air, but like if you get your book reviewed in a large newspaper, you know, as we'll say New York Times, they review your book. That is fantastic. You might get a blurb out of it, something that you can use as an author. But if that review lands in somebody's inbox, they're going to click on the link to try and read it and they're going to hit a paywall. They're not going to be able to read that review unless they sign up for that newspaper. Now, if a blogger or an influencer, if they talk about your book, you know, they get out there, they put it on the web, they put it all over social media, they promote the hell out of it. And you know, like to me, that is worth paying for. Like they're generating more sales than that traditional model is.
Yeah.
No, so I think that at this point it just hasn't been recognized and it needs to be.
And I think the strategy, you know, depending on what your personal budget is and what, you know, what you can actually afford to do. I mean, the ebooks are free. You can always offer ebooks. If people are, I've run across a lot of bloggers and podcasters who insist on a physical book. I take a look at what their demographic is. Like what kind of audience do they have? Do they have numbers that could justify the expense it's going to take for me to send them? And if it's big enough, I have a threshold, but if it's big enough, I will gladly send copies, multiple copies, if that's what they want. I've had people ask for like, you know, 3 copies of a book before because they have like an editorial team that they distribute to. So,
well, you know, if they're filming a video, it's a prop, right? You want,
yeah.
They want to be able to hold it up. They want to be able to use it somehow in their video. So it to me, it's always been worth it.
Yeah, I think it's worth it. So, all right. Well, good. I'm glad. I mean, and things are starting to kind of die down on that front, right? Like you're not getting hit full frontal with that anymore.
I think now that the facts are out there and people understand what really happened and realize that this could kind of happen to them. You know, it's died down a little bit. Yeah, the book is coming out in another month. The pre-sales are strong. The movie's moving forward nice and fast. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And that book is, like you said, it's coming out in about a month, a little over a month, Behind a Closed Door. Where can people find that book and more about you?
The book the launch date is May 13th. My website is jdbarker.com, so that's the easiest place to find me, but the book is pretty much everywhere. If you walk into your local bookstore, you can place a pre-order, or Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all the usual suspects.
Go out, get it, make sure that you read it publicly with you know, with your eyes, you know. I'm gonna read it behind a closed door.
You're digging a hole.
Yeah, I'm digging a hole. I'm just getting worse. All right. Thank you, JD, for hopping in, talking to us about it. I know this was not easy. That's why we saved it for the end.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, everybody, thank you for tuning in. And make sure you go pick up a pre-order of Behind a Closed Door, probably on Amazon. That's where most of you are going to go. But anywhere books are sold, that's good news for everybody. So, again, thanks to JD Barker. And we'll see you on the other side. Well, that was my good friend, JD. I hope you enjoyed that interview. There's that whole thing with that email. Like I said, I got to see all that unfold live. And I got to see the actual story. But it was really interesting to see the reaction of the public. And I had people in my circles, friends, who knew that I was that I did the show with JD, who immediately went straight to the most negative perspective on it and came to me asking, like, you know, some people asked, like, sorry, you're leaving the show, right? Like they really, they felt like maybe I was putting myself in some sort of harm's way by sticking it out and sticking beside JD on it. And the thing was, like, I would try to explain to some of them the reality of what had happened. And I think even with this interview, there's still going to be people out there who just aren't going to accept the reality of it or the truth of it. They've determined. I think there's a lesson there for us too, right? We can't control how other people perceive us. We can't control the way things play out in the world. The only thing we can control, the only thing we have any control over, is our own responses to the world, our own perspective we can choose, and let's choose to be a light to the world. Let's choose to be something good in the world. I learned a lot from this because I was one of those people who, you know, I would hear like something celebrity gossip or something. And I, you know, I was quick to make my judgments. So now this has slowed me down on that. Now it's more about, you know, let's see if we can find some truth. Let's see if we can hear things out and let's give people the benefit of the doubt instead of rushing to judge them. But I recognize that's not going to be the case for everybody. So, anyway, wherever you fall on that, I hope, You know, I hope that this, I hope this story maybe at least helps prepare you for that moment when this might happen to you. All of us have sent the email or the text message that we weren't intending to send. There's no taking that back. You can't unring the bell. So sometimes, unless you're on YouTube, you can totally unring a bell on YouTube, which please don't. But I think the lesson there is, you know, this can happen to all of us, any of us, and it's our response to it that's going to make the biggest difference. Continue to be, you know, who you are, authentic to yourself, and tell the truth. You can apologize when you've done something wrong, but don't apologize to the mob. Apologize to the person you hurt, but don't apologize to the public. The public, they'll only see that. It's like a pack of wolves. They see that as weakness, and they're just going to tear you apart. Just be authentic to yourself and be kind and loving to others. And whatever it is that's happened, it will work out. One way or another. There's always going to be somebody who just continues to hold on to hate, but and hold on to grudges and hold on to bad judgments. But, you know, those people, that's none of your business. Those people can go and live their lives, and you're going to go live yours. So, anyway, let's roll right into, let's wrap things up, because I this one went a little long, and I want to make sure that we, you know, get you everything you came here for. If you came here for this, you're going to have to let me know. Let me know in the comments on YouTube or send me a quick note to let me know what you think of the show, what you think of a particular episode. Ask me anything. The Ask Kevin Anything segment is something I'm really hoping takes off. And it's literally ask me anything you want. Anything. Marketing, something about publishing, writing, books, whatever. That's great. But you can ask me about, you know, quantum physics, history, anthropology, whatever you want, anything you want. It's the world's your oyster. So ask me anything. I won't promise to answer every single question, but what I'm going to do is use this as a launch point, because part of what I do for a living is go and research things, learn things, so that I can share them with my readers and with my podcast audience. So when you ask me questions, it's a good prompt for me to go dig into something maybe I've never explored before. So ask Kevin anything. All right. And this week, Lynn Hallbrooks asked, I'm going to pop this up. See, it just popped up on screen. And, here's the question, from your experiences, what do you think is the best way to grow your audience, be it books, videos, or other art forms? And Lynn, thank you. Cause Lynn is very supportive online. And I appreciate that. I love you, Lynn. So building an audience, what's the best way to grow your audience? The number one thing I think is happening right now for me, that and what I'm starting to realize is very effective, is consistency. So whatever it is you produce, so if you're writing books, if you're writing blog posts, if you're producing videos and podcasts, there's a lot of debate right now. There's several people I talk to who have sort of opinions on, like, you know, on YouTube, you need to be putting like X number of videos up a week, and you need to be doing these, you know, XYZ things. I think that stuff does work, and I think it is important, but I do not like tailoring my life to any form of algorithm. Like, I don't want to live an algorithm life. I want the algorithm of life to be the only thing that I serve. And so I tend to shy away from that stuff. That stuff can be very effective. It can help you grow an audience and probably grow it fast. So, you know, consider that. But I think the number one message to cling to is consistency. And so if you're writing books, you know, make sure that you are consistently applying yourself to those books, but also consistently learning more about craft, more about the marketing, more about your reader. Be consistent in that as much as being consistent about writing and producing the books. You know, one book can make a career, but it's kind of rare. But I think the key for that, you know, no matter how many books you release, if it's just one book, be consistent about something that moves you forward every day, in reaching that audience. So for example, you know, if you're promoting, however you choose to promote your book, if you're going to do blog posts or ads or whatever, you know, make sure you're learning and applying things as you go, and that you are consistent about the creation of those things. So, you know, I write a Substack. It's kevintomlinson.substack.com. You can read my little newsletter, The Writer, which I post every Friday. And that's the key, is every Friday I write and post an article or a piece, an essay, basically, on that Substack. Here's the trick, though. And I was just talking with Johnny Truant, which I've got an upcoming interview with him for the Wordslinger podcast, Johnny B. Truant. And we had a great conversation, but one of the things we talked about was, like, it's so hard when you're doing all this and you're putting in all this work and effort and energy and you're not seeing a return. And that makes you want to quit. And sometimes that's the right answer. Sometimes when you just are pouring yourself into something, you're not seeing any movement. It means that your energy is going into the void. So it's time to pivot. That could be true. But it's equally true that sometimes you're 15 feet from gold. Meaning, if you just kept at it just a little longer, you'd break through. How do you know? You don't. But it kind of comes down to the why of what you're doing. Like, if you know why you're doing what you're doing. If I know, so for me, on my Substack, I am The Writer. That's what I call my newsletter. And I know that the reason I'm doing it is because I have to write. Writing is something I do. It's just something I have to do. So that's my reason. So the reason determines whether or not I continue doing it. If my reason is I need to draw readers who will pay for a paid Substack subscription, or who will go buy my books, or those metrics, then that will tell me, you know, how far along I am in success. And if I've written, you know, 3 months of articles or essays on that Substack, and I'm nowhere close to that goal, I'm not seeing any movement towards that goal, now it's time to pivot and stop and do something else. But if the goal is continue to write, use it as a venue for expressing myself, and whatever comes will come, then there's no reason to not continue to do it. So anyway, there you go. I hope that helps. There's probably a lot more I could add to this, but we're already running long, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. But thank you for being a part of the Wordslinger podcast. Make sure that you click like and subscribe and the little bell. The bell will alert you when new episodes go live. And there's other stuff I plan to do and intend to do on my channel here on YouTube, but the Wordslinger podcast is going to be kind of the primary content. So if you like what you're hearing and seeing, make sure you do that. Now, for those of you who are listening to the audio only version of this podcast, you know, make sure you subscribe as well, wherever you're listening. And for everybody, you're going to help me out a lot if you will share this show in whatever form you prefer to everyone you know. So thank you for that. It helps me. It helps the guests who are on the show. And I think ultimately it's going to help you, because the more, you know, the greater, the bigger this show gets, the greater the reach of the show, the easier it is for me to get, you know, new guests from a wider range of industries and levels of success. And we can all learn from that group and all grow together. Consistent growth. So thank you again for being a part of the show, and we'll see you next time.
Wordslinger.